Pleased to have Mark Silva. The Chicago Tribune is our guest, who's a White House correspondent. And Mark, I'd like to start out asking you about the news business, how you got into it. What your education and how you chose news.
Sure. Well, I was a young man. I was at Brown University. I was in my senior year at Brown University without a clue what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I was an English major. I liked to write and fancied myself a playwright, actually, and had fashioned a concentration in playwriting in the English department. Had a play produced. Couldn't really see a future as a playwright. But anyway, that was my fancy. And so as senior year came around, I started to get more practical. And I was in the library with a buddy of mine, and we were looking at graduate school catalogs, and I was thinking about history and some sort of graduate degree. And he was looking at the journalism school at Columbia. And so I started getting interested, which made him really nervous, because at the time they only took about 125 students each year, and still not much more than that. So I decided to apply, and that made him really angry because he figured that was lessening his chances. We both got in.
Uh-huh.
We both went. And I found my way through really a practice that I hadn't spent much time doing. I had done a lot of writing. I'd written for magazines about music and art, and I'd written plays, but I hadn't done any news writing at all. So really I spent the year learning, and which is what it was for. And when I came out of Columbia, I went to work for a newspaper. And at the time, it was very difficult to get a job at a decent newspaper, so I started a small newspaper, and I spent a few years at small papers. And I went to the Miami Herald, which I spent a long time at, and worked my way up through politics and government, and covered campaigns, presidential campaigns and politics, and came to Washington for the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference in the kind, in the ways that you cover a story when you're at a small paper as opposed to a large paper? Are there certain kinds of things that are similar?
Well, the big difference is at a small paper you do everything. And, mm-hmm. and really, to some degree, I heard somebody once speak derisively about the idea of having to go spend their, you know, pay their dues at some 35,000 circulation newspaper, because really it's a great learning experience. You not only learn, but you make your mistakes, and you make them in a place that they don't cost you. They sort of, you know, they're left by the side and nobody remembers them. You're not in a market big enough that it makes a difference. So it's the big difference is you do a lot more writing and reporting, and one story a day would be considered a slow day at a small paper. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have your hands in two or three different stories on any given day generally. And at a big paper, you know, you generally have the luxury of, if not concentrating on one during a day, at least having a week or two or longer to delve into something more substantive. So you spend a lot more time working on a particular story at a big paper. At a small paper, you spend a lot less time in each story, and you have your hands in a lot more stories.
Uh-huh. So you really have to learn kind of all the substantive areas. You'd have to learn economic issues. You'd have to learn kind of policy issues in a local paper.
Right.
Budgeting of the local area.
Right.
Plus the politics.
Right. A lot of reporting is learning as you go. And ultimately, hopefully, if you didn't enter with a clear idea of a concentration or an expertise, you develop it after time. You find out what you like. And you know, so for instance, I learned pretty early on that I liked government. I knew that I liked politics, and I spent a lot of time covering government, which I wasn't so crazy about. But it's the political side of things that really interested me. And so I spent a lot of time covering, you know, state budgets and the ins and outs of state government, and then federal politics. And now on the White House beat, you know, similarly, I've spent a lot of time learning about foreign policy that I hadn't spent my life thinking about very deeply. So, you know, I've gone to school on foreign policy in the last several years.
Uh-huh. How have you learned it? Because in a way, it's difficult once you come to the White House to learn, because they're you just have to do so many different things.
Right. You learn by a lot of reading, and the internet has made life so much easier.
Uh-huh.
Because you can, you know, at your fingertips, you can delve into any subject very quickly. University websites are great, you know, good solid research websites that that provide background, think tanks, the Brookings, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Council on Foreign Relations, any of the good serious think tanks have voluminous resources about every country in the world. The CIA fact book provides you. I mean, anytime I enter a country, I sit down and read both the State Department and the CIA fact book background on the country, just to, refresh my, my mind about things that I had known and forgotten or things I didn't know. And, in a very short time on the internet, in a day's time, you can get up to speed pretty fast on something you didn't know much about. Nuclear enrichment, what's the difference between enriching uranium for civilian power generation versus, weapon construction. You can learn that in a day. And then once you've got sort of a working knowledge and you can get around well enough to ask intelligent questions without making a fool of yourself, you can call on experts, and they educate you as well. And in the conversations that you have with experts, people that you interview for stories and who provide you with good quotes and, insight into your stories, you learn from them as well. And then you really feel like you've learned something when you know more about something than you're asking. It's hard to describe, but you realize you're up to speed when you feel like the person you're interviewing is not telling you something new. There's just a wealth of resources, and the internet makes life really, really easy.
It's also helpful to learn to that depth too, because you can use an issue as a thread to find out things about the White House, how it operates, how the decision-making system works. If you really know an area very well, you can tell how decisions are made by looking at who's involved in the decision-making process.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And there's no question that it really behooves someone to bring a specialty to the job. I mean, I entered as a generalist, and I've learned as I've gone. But I think someone who approached the White House with a really good, serious background in military affairs and armament issues, or anything really, healthcare, a really good, serious background in any domestic or foreign issue is at a huge advantage, because you know the terrain, and you know who's serious, and you know who's not, and you know who the players are, and you know who the posers are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that David Sanger's knowledge of North Korea was very helpful to him when he was covering the White House.
That's a great example. David Sanger knows more about the whole Korean situation than any reporter in the business, and so he's he travels the world, and he's got the sources, and he produces stories that really nobody else can on that subject.
Sometimes you'd notice that when he would start asking a question on North Korea, that whoever the press secretary was would be nervous.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because he realized a press secretary has generally, a press secretary is a lot like a reporter in many ways, a generalist, yeah, and knows what he or she has been briefed about. And you can pretty much find the limits of their knowledge pretty quickly, because they're not experts in their field. They're the people that the administration has put out there to talk.
Right.
And their knowledge has its boundaries.
Uh-huh. What do you find a press secretary useful for? What do you get from a press secretary?
For my money, the best thing a press secretary can do is, on background, help you understand something, the depth of something, or the intricacies of it. It's not so much standing up at the podium and delivering a quote. It's more putting you in touch with people in the administration who are working on something to help you understand what's right and what's wrong about. You enter a subject, you hear from critics, you hear criticism, you hear things, and to sort of sort through the chaff of all the stuff you hear from Capitol Hill and from think tanks, and to say, no, this is why this is not true, or this is why this could be true, to help inform you. And on deadline, to help put you in touch with the people that you need to find this out quickly and often at odd hours. Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, was releasing a proposal for an overhaul of the financial markets regulation recently. And typically the White House dropped it on a Friday afternoon to the New York Times. They gave it to the Times, which meant that every other paper would have to follow it on Saturday, which meant that it would be on the front pages of everyone's Sunday papers and the subject of the Sunday morning talk shows. Well, there you are on a Saturday trying to figure out what the Treasury Department is going to do about re-regulating the financial markets. Yeah. And talk about a situation where you need real help real fast. There was a press secretary at the White House that was able to arrange things for me to talk to the right people and find out what I needed to find out to write.
Yeah. Well, in that case, Tony Fratto is somebody who knows the financial.
And he had come from Treasury.
Yeah. So he's very knowledgeable in it.
Right.
Often we at the White House, it seems that the press secretaries are don't necessarily know a great deal themselves, as you were saying, but they're facilitators of information. In a way, that's the way they should be judged. It's I think people generally who are watching a White House from the outside look at the daily briefing and make their judgments about a whole press operation, a communications operation, and the press secretary by looking at that briefing.
Well, the truth is the public makes a lot of its judgments about the White House in general by looking at the press secretary. During the CIA leak case, when Scott McClellan's job was to go out there every day and not answer the questions, he did it unfailingly. And from the public's perception, watching that on television, you get the image of a White House stonewalling. But that was his assignment. And in fact, that's what the White House was doing. They were stonewalling on the question. And he went day in, day out after there and did the same thing over and over again. And later come to learn that he'd been deceived by his own bosses about what Karl Rove's involvement may or may not have been and all of that. So he was used. But the face of the White House and the voice of the White House is more than a communicator with reporters. It's a communicator with the nation, really. And the president has, one press conference every 2 months now? Pretty much that's the schedule he's on. So it's not the president people hear from generally. It's the administration and the press secretary day in and day out.
Are there other ways that a press secretary can provide information? You were saying providing some information on background. I've noticed that one of the things that Dana Perino has done, something that Tony Snow didn't do, or Scott, or Ari, and that is that she puts a lot of effort into bringing people to the podium who are specialists in particular areas, like when the discussion was of Columbia Free Trade.
Right.
They brought up three people who were experts on it. Paulson's been been to the briefing room a couple of times.
Right.
She has seemed to be able to bring more people in. And I'm not sure who she had to convince on that, whether it's convincing the president that more people needed to speak, that there are more, in a sense, there are more newsmakers.
Right.
And you need to put the experts out there.
Well, I think in some ways it's an acknowledgement of a couple things. It's an acknowledgement maybe that she's not totally, versed in some of the things she knows she's going to be confronting, and rather than sort of muddle through things that, she knows her own limits on, she defers to an expert, and that's good. A press secretary in Washington has become sort of the gate between the public and the government, and they're everywhere. I mean, every committee has a press secretary, every agency has a press secretary, every subcommittee has a press secretary, and often they really serve as, in the field, the derogatory term is flack.
Yeah.
They stand between you and what you need, and in many cases, that's what press secretaries are. They're flacks for their bosses and for their organizations. So often if a press secretary can kind of get out of the way and provide you the access that you need to the person who actually is expert in the field, that's a good thing. And a press secretary who's comfortable doing that also has conceded a certain amount of, ego. Tony Snow, when he came in early, I remember his first gaggle, somebody asked him an economic question, and he said, "Look, I'm just going to tell you, I'm not in a position to answer questions about the economy right now. I'm not going to move markets with ill-considered, comments." And I'm not sure he ever really did get totally comfortable with the economy, but he learned. So I mean, the ability to acknowledge what your own limits are is a helpful thing, but also the the willingness to sort of get out of the way and allow you to talk directly with the people that actually have spent their careers in whatever the field is and are now in the White House, mm-hmm. at the top of their game, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Most White Houses have seemed to do more of that. But in the Clinton administration, they had a lot of people out in the briefing room,
right.
A lot of cabinet secretaries, and a lot of, well, they have domestic policy people. Bruce Reed was out there a lot, and Jack Lew from OMB was
right.
there. And so you had a lot of it. These people have been, the Bush people have been a little less willing to do
well,
that.
Well, this has been, until recently,
yeah.
until the past year, this has been an exceptionally disciplined White House, which played a message game really exquisitely. Whether you agree with what the message was or not, I remember during the 2004 campaign one day calling up the White House, the Republican National Committee, and the Bush campaign, the reelection campaign, on a story. And you're on deadline, you're running, and you're flying, and you're taking notes, and you're sitting down and looking at it afterwards. And I remember sitting down and looking at my notes from all three of those conversations and realizing all three of those people had told me the same thing. And in
mm-hmm.
fact, had used many of the same words. And every morning, you know, there's a meeting, and the message is decided on an issue, and that's those are the orders for the day. And this White House, I mean, until a year ago, if this White House was about to appoint somebody as a cabinet secretary, nobody knew who it was until the appointment. I mean,
mm-hmm.
some of the best-kept secrets I've ever seen. And I can actually tell some stories about that, about how they enforced that, but a very disciplined operation.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Tell a story.
I remember once going to the White House Mess, which is a lovely restaurant beneath the West Wing, and it's like an old men's club. It's paneled, and there's two shifts. There's a early lunch and a late lunch, and there's service by the Navy, and it's all very elegant and formal. And I was sitting there with a guy in the White House who I was invited by. An assistant to the president. There's only about 17 or 18 assistants to the president. And he informed me at the beginning that, you know, I should keep it low key because reporters weren't allowed in there.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, are you going to get yourself in trouble? And he said, well, don't worry about it. He was on his way out. And he said, you know, I'm tired of the rules in this place. And this person went on to explain to me how once Andy Card, the chief of staff, had called a lot of senior people into the White House, into an inner office, and said, you know, I really want to thank you for all your sacrifice and your time and everything you've devoted and the time away from your families and the, you know, just the complete personal sacrifice and devotion of your duty here. And I also want you to know how important it is that everything that's said here stays here and the trust we place in you, the confidence we place in you to obey that. Door opens up, the president walks in. President says, hi, I'm glad everybody's here today, and, you know, I just really want to thank you, you know, from the bottom of my heart for your service and your sacrifice and your time away from your family and your discipline and just the personal toll this 7-to-9 job takes on your life and family. And also, I just really want you to know how important it is to me that I have your confidence and trust, and I know that what we do stays among us. And the message is about as clear as it could be, you know, talk
yeah.
and get your knees broken or, you know, find another job.
Yeah.
So, and that happened, that happened a number of times.
Do you think that had, what were the benefits and the drawbacks for them? It had consequences of various kinds, I think, having a system like that.
I think the drawbacks are that it insulated the White House.
Mm-hmm.
I think as much as the White House would like to pretend that President Bush listens to a lot of very discordant, points of view, that I don't think there is as much of that. And I think the White House's insistence on a certain discipline has worked against it in many ways, allowed it to proceed without really understanding the conflicting points of view on a lot of issues. I think it also has prevented the public from knowing George Bush better, frankly. George Bush is a personable guy who anybody would be happy to have as a next-door neighbor. You know, he's a hail fellow, well met. He's a lot of fun to be around. He personally can take it. You know, with the best of them, you can say things to him and to the first lady. They don't mind criticism and I think the White House has created a wall and a veil around George Bush that has prevented really the public from understanding him as a person. And it's unfortunate because it's happened at a time when the central theme of his presidency is a war that has become, unpopular.
Yeah.
And his legacy, is, so to speak, will be looked upon largely as the war. So there's a very shallow understanding of George Bush the man at a time when people are becoming increasingly predisposed to not like George Bush the president.
Mm-hmm.
People are unhappy with his policies, and his approval ratings are in the tank, and he's below 30 in many measures and has been for a couple of years, and will go down remembered that way. I think the walls that they've built around the president have not served them for those reasons, and have also not served him for that reason.
Uh-huh. One of the things that was surprising to me in a press conference that he had, one of his solo newsers in the briefing room, John Cochran asked him about what he had learned in the White House that he thought was important for his successors. And looking at people who are going to be the next president, what are some of the things that it's important to know and to know about them? And so he said that he thought that it was important that to know what kind of person they were going to be in the Oval Office, that it was very important that you have a lot of different points of view.
Right.
And if you remember that discussion, and I think everybody in the room, was surprised.
Right.
Because that didn't seem to be the hallmark of his presidency.
No.
And so one wondered whether how they view the different, how he views getting different points of view,
mm-hmm.
how he sees that process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any, have you been able to get into the decision-making process and whether it's evolved and how it's evolved, say, under Bolton as opposed to Andy
right.
Card?
The truth is, and I'll readily admit, it remains largely a mystery to me.
Mm-hmm.
I do know the process that they go about. I know the sort of the calendar, the clock that they follow each day, who meets when with who, and how they sort of build up the sort of filters. The chief of staff sets out very early in the morning to try to get the lay of the land and to bring everybody in from the senior and assistant senior levels and funnel it up to the president. But when it comes time to decision making, I think this remains largely one of the mysteries. And again, this goes a little bit to what I was suggesting that's done them disservice, because I think if people did understand it a little bit better, they might actually appreciate it. Maybe there is a robust knockdown argument once a week about Iraq, maybe that does take place, but I don't think any of us are convinced of it. And then there's this whole question about how decisions have been made vis-a-vis the vice president. And the whole parallel structure that the vice president has created. He's got his own administration. He's got his own National Security Council and team.
His own briefings.
His own briefings. And there was that time when it was alleged by, Steve Wilkerson that, his staff was spying on the NSC staff of the White House, reading mm-hmm. their emails. And this whole parallel government. And to travel with the vice president is a very interesting experience, because it's very much like you're traveling with the president. He's got his whole team and his briefings. So I think that's one of the more intriguing elements of the Bush White House is how the Cheney-Bush decisions were overlaid. In that whole midst, you had, Colin Powell and why he was, pushed out and why Condi Rice, who is essentially more of a, follower of the administration's rules and policies, was elevated. So, I think there will be some great work done in retrospect. I suspect. I think in retrospect we'll start to find out some really interesting things about how decisions were made in the White House that we don't know today.
Uh huh. It's going to be something that's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
Before the materials come out.
Yeah.
And Cheney in a speech. Maybe it was a year or so ago. He was in Grand Rapids. and he was at the Ford Library.
I was there with him.
Maybe it was from your pool report that you had quoted the part where he said, he laughed and said, "You won't find much of me here."
Right.
Indicating that he didn't commit a lot to paper.
That's right.
One of the things that surprised me about their operation has been the material that's come out in court in the Lewis Libby case.
Right.
That the notes that were subpoenaed from Kathy Martin, for example, they had handwriting, notes that were in handwriting. It wasn't just stuff that was in a computer.
Right.
And so I thought that actually, if that is a sample, there are going to be documents.
Oh, there will be a lot of documents.
Yeah. That stuff, they just couldn't shred everything.
No, and that 12-year clock will run its full length with this administration.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was this president who signed the executive order on previous records, allowing a good 12-year review.
Uh-huh.
One of the first orders he signed in the White House. So it'll be a long time before there's a good full disclosure.
I would imagine that one of the things that's going to go, whether it's a Democratic, whoever wins, whether it's McCain or a Democrat, that order is going to go. Obama has signed on to rescind it.
Yeah.
And it's gone through the House.
Yeah.
And it's been on a hold in the Senate.
Yeah.
And the Republicans have been rotating who's put the hold on.
Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton was not a sponsor, but I think she indicated that she was going to be.
Yeah.
And McCain is an open kind of person.
Right.
So I would think that it's become such a symbol that it's something that that might go, but they'd still have that 12 years that they would have to wait. But at least there's some indication there'll be some information there.
Mm-hmm.
Cheney seems to have been a very difficult person to follow, and you have followed him. That one of the things that have happened is very few people have traveled with him.
Right.
And I don't know whether that's news organizations have not wanted to send people with him, figuring that he wasn't going to talk to anybody, so why go through the expense? Or they didn't want to have people along with them.
Well, that's part of it is the fact that he doesn't talk much. They've set up a pool or a rotation. When the vice president travels, the people that are willing to travel and underwrite the cost of it, because we pay when we travel, they rotate among us. And once they offered me a trip to Saudi Arabia and back, and I said, well, what is the access going to be? Well, there's no access.
Was that the King Fahd funeral?
Yeah.
Because they didn't get anybody. Nobody went
on that. And they asked people, they said, would you like to travel? And the answer is, well, what do we get? Well, you get a seat on a plane. Well, thank you. And so people didn't go. I went around the world with them on a trip which was supposed to include a number of public appearances in Tokyo and Guam and Australia. And we ended up on that trip going to Afghanistan and Pakistan,
right.
And we went clear around the world to come home. And we were on the road for 9 days. And they had promised us, news availabilities like in Australia and where we could ask questions and that sort of thing. But there was never any firm commitment about any kind of interview or time. And when it was all said and done, we spent 65 hours in airplanes, both Air Force Two and in cargo planes flying surreptitiously in and out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we had 18 minutes with the vice president. And those 18 minutes in the belly of a cargo plane coming out of Afghanistan, we went into those 18 minutes told that this was going to be on background. In other words, we couldn't say who we were talking with. And we said, are you kidding me? This is the vice president. And they said, those are the conditions. Do you want to talk or not? So you're in an airplane, you're a pool reporter whose obligation is to provide a pool report to the rest of the press, and so you're not going to boycott it. You can't say, no, I'm not going in there. So you go in, and he says, okay, he's the senior administration official. 1 minute into his conversation, he says, people say that Cheney went to Pakistan to beat up on Musharraf. That's not the way I operate.
Uh-huh.
So we're all looking at each other, scratching our heads, going, "Well, is the transcript going to reflect this?" And because he blew his cover 60 seconds in, and sure enough, the White House, God love them, in many ways, they're faithful to these.
Right.
These transcripts are faithful to the to the every illiterate utterance, and sure enough, there he was. So when I got back, I wrote a piece about the absurdity of the senior administration official in Washington, and you tell me who this senior administration official is, and I got a good ride out of that. I got on TV for it, you know.
Uh-huh.
but I mean the so I you know I think a lot of people don't jump at the opportunity to travel with Cheney because you know that you're not going to get a lot of insight.
Uh-huh. You know? Well, the students came to Washington,
yeah,
and we heard a background briefing. But we had an interview with Dana, and before it, we got to hear a background briefing on FISA and on the legislation up on the Hill, and there was an official from the Justice Department and one from National Intelligence, and they both referred to each other by name.
Yeah.
And it was a background briefing.
Right.
And so you do end up with that.
Right.
Well, on your trip, your pool reports were very important because people found out about the attack on the base in Afghanistan, where you all were staying.
Right.
Your pool reports are renowned for their depth and for just a an accurate picture of what was going on.
Thanks.
It's like going back, and I don't know if you've gone back and read any 19th century reporting from the White House. There was a guy named William Price who wrote a column at the White House. And when he's traveling with the president, there were all sorts of things he, because there's no television, no radio, that he has to describe of what the place was like, who the people were, what the people were like. And you provide that in your pool reports.
Well, thanks. There's nothing that annoys me more than a pool report that says this, uneventful motorcade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry. When the president moves in a motorcade, it's eventful. Something happens. People see him. He passes something. There's an event. So there's always something to report about. And when you're a pool reporter, you know, your obligation is to be the eyes and ears of the people who aren't there. And on a trip like Cheney's, when you're, you know, around the world in nine days, you see a lot.
And especially if the base gets attacked while you're there.
Yeah, especially if the base gets attacked. And Cheney had told us, you know, we were deep inside the base when that attack happened at the gate, a big base, and the attack was at the gate, and people died. But Cheney and we were well within, and so the question was, you know, did you take any precautions? And the inference at the time was, well, no, I was in the VIP quarters, and they came and told me that it was no problem, there was nothing wrong. Months later, somebody referred to that incident, a member of his staff, by saying, when they came to get us down to, and took us down to the bunker, we were only in the bunker for about, you know, 5 minutes. So Cheney's, you know, the initial thing we were told about Cheney being fine in his VIP quarters wasn't quite exactly what he was pulled to the bunker.
Yeah, but I think you find that sometimes when they're talking about presidential health, that people say, well, the president, well, like Reagan,
right?
You know, the first stories of Reagan,
right.
Well, you know, it's no big thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you have to hand it to the White House for being forthcoming about a lot of issues. The vice president's had 4 heart attacks, and if you've ever read the records of the president's medical visits, they're pretty detailed.
Yeah, they certainly are. I mean, they
more than you want to know.
That's right. I mean, fill out those were not things that they would release on a previous president, because they were just forms. They just give you all of the forms.
Right.
And we've certainly gone through periods where we have not known a lot about presidents.
Right.
Occasionally we would, like when McKinley was shot, his secretary, who would be comparable to the chief of staff, held regular meetings during the day with doctors to report on how he was doing until close to the end, when I think everybody knew that he was dying.
Mm.
And then Eisenhower, but, you know, kind of everybody in between, you know, including afterwards Kennedy.
Right.
You know, you really didn't know a lot about the president's health, and I think people are much more interested in it. When looking at their message operation, one of the things that seems to be a casualty of it, and I don't know if it's inherent in having a tight operation like that, is that they are good at saying, announcing what it is that they're doing.
Right.
But they're not good at listening. that's not built into the operation. And I'm not sure if that's because an operation that advocates as much as theirs does, people just don't feel that they can stop and listen at the same time.
Well, I think that's true, and I think there's a lack of sort of public discussion. It's as you say, there are announcements, and the White House always coordinates a speech that's got something substantive in it with a fact sheet, and the fact sheet is really a replay of the speech. The fact sheet is presented as some sort of document that is a reliable resource. These are the facts of the situation. Well, actually, what they are is they're the assertions that were made in the speech in bullet form, in some sort of outline that you can easily digest. And I think, in some ways it's kind of demeaning because I think maybe they think we're not smart enough to figure it out. But it's not. The one time a year when you really get facts dumped on your lap is when the federal budget is proposed. And OMB produces volumes of statistical information about the nature of the debt and the deficit you can learn a lot about the federal budget and you can do it all year round. You can go to the OMB website and read these documents. There's a wealth of information that's disclosed that is factual, mm-hmm. They don't do that on healthcare or Medicare or during the whole period of the president's attempts to get people to look at Social Security differently and to think about private, savings accounts. There wasn't a lot of good factual information produced about why this problem was as acute right. as they thought it was. I don't think they do a particularly good job of helping you understand the imperative behind an issue. Again, at budget time, it's all there and you can figure it out, and there's more than you need. And among the things you can figure out in their own documents this year, you could see that they are going to deliver us a record deficit this year by virtue of the war in Iraq, which they won't concede. Nobody will stand up at a podium at the White House and tell you that the White House will deliver another record deficit this year, but it's all there in the budget documents. All you got to do is read it.
Uh-huh. I've thought that it was done twice a year, the two budgets or two discussions with a briefer that were superb were the briefings that Mitch Daniels did.
Yeah, yeah.
And where he would stand up for as long as the front row would sit there.
Right.
And answer questions and impressively so.
Right.
He really knew his stuff.
Right. Right.
And that that's something that works for them.
Right.
But they never quite saw that.
Well, again, I think every time they put out in public, or not necessarily in public, but make an interview available to somebody like that who knows their stuff, they do themselves a favor, because ultimately, the more a reporter understands an issue, the better the story is going to be. The more truthful and less subject to sort of if you look at your email on any given day from Capitol Hill and you see the stuff that's flying from the majority office and the minority office and all the sort of rhetoric that's flying around if you don't give people much information to work with, then it's easy for them to just sort of grab the clutter. And it's easy to compile a story with a lot of criticism. They said this, he said that. Well, mm-hmm. How about some good hard facts to discuss? And I think, again, I'm being a little repetitive on this, but I think they could have done themselves a greater service and the public a greater service by making experts more available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Recently, the White House, let's say in the second term, one of the things that they've done that they did not do so much of before is they took their rapid response operation from the campaign and brought it over to the White House,
right.
And have sent out to a large number of people within the government and talk radio and reporters and experts of various kinds when it's an issue that relates to them, email messages that in case you missed it, which might have an editorial that that somebody in the White House published under their name as if speech writing operation wrote or whatever. But then they also have fact sheets, and then they set out a category of emails called Setting the Record Straight.
Setting the Record Straight, right.
And they had one the other day where they really gave a reporter a hair fire over an article that appeared on Thursday in the New York Times that said the president was invisible. Mm-hmm. And were you surprised by the tone of that email?
It was very personal. They've been doing this with the New York Times in particular for some time now. The White House has an abused spouse relationship with the New York Times, I think. They rely on the New York Times to get the message out and to float big ideas, like Paulson's overhaul of the markets. You know, they gave that to the New York Times on a Friday because the New York Times is important, and that's where they wanted to float it. And then they turn around and they whack a New York Times reporter for doing her job, basically. So on the one hand, they rely on the Times to help advance their agenda, float the things they want to float when they want to float them, and then they whack reporters upside the head, you know, for simple stories that, you know, the story was fine. It was a fine story, and there's no percentage in that. There's nothing gained in publicly berating a newspaper for a story that you don't like. If you got a problem with a story, you call up the reporter, call up the editor maybe. You know, you want to complain, but you know, you don't hang out, you don't do a public execution of a story.
Yeah. Have they ever had a Setting the Record Straight on you?
I'm happy to say I've survived. maybe I'm just enough below the radar, but no, they've never hung me out to dry.
Have they ever called you up and complained?
Yes. And frankly, it was a pretty valid complaint. If I went into it, it would betray a confidence because it was on background. It was a valid complaint, and nothing. It wasn't egregious, or it was suggesting that I really hadn't taken into account something. And I think in retrospect, they were right.
Uh huh.
And you know, I can take criticism.
Uh huh. Do you have to do anything with it?
Well, no. Actually, it was more in the order of kind of helping me understand something better the next time I wrote on the subject. It was not assuming something that I shouldn't be assuming. I hate to be so vague, but it wasn't confidence, and so it enabled me to think more clearly about a particular issue the next time I wrote about it.
I talked to somebody who said that they had gotten a series of calls. Day after day,
yeah.
Over a correction, and that was that when Bush spoke, had a speech that the news organization had said that the stock market had gone down, and in reality, it had gone up afterwards, so the White House wanted that corrected.
Oh yeah,
and in a way, you know, that wasn't a minor, matter.
No. And when we make errors of fact, we correct them, we set the record straight in the paper.
Uh huh. Yeah. And now, when a record is corrected, it's much better than it was in the past because it comes up when you go on to Nexus,
and
you pull up an article,
right.
The correction will be with it.
Right.
So it's not like it just goes into the to the atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. The internet's made us all a lot smarter in a lot of ways. It's enabled us to figure out things a lot more quickly, and it's also a font, as you know, of just endless. Mischief and bad things, and in the era that we're working in, on the White House beat and on the presidential campaign beat, there's all kinds of stuff that floats on the internet that you have to make a very quick decision about whether you take this seriously or not, and whether the source is reliable, and ultimately you'll find some other paper will bite on it if you don't, and it's a very fast paced environment. It's a little dangerous, and it really requires a whole lot of caution.
Yeah, it seems that one of the problems is the central problem is that there is an enormous amount of information, but there is a lack of understanding, and so how do you make sense of all of that? And I was talking to a White House person about it who was saying that that was a basic part of his job, was to try to do that too within the White House, mm-hmm. of trying to bring understanding to mm-hmm. it, and mm-hmm. that it's really hard to do. Mm-hmm. Because for the same reasons, you know, you've got to decide, is something right or is it not? Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at some of the things, kind of the small things. The fact-checking is seemed to be particularly important, and people have been able to see which fact-checking was correct and what wasn't, like Smoking Gun,
right.
Bringing up the case of the article the LA Times wrote, using FBI documents that turned out not to be accurate on P. Diddy and what role he had in a shooting. And then their story got shot down and got shot down fast,
right,
which
right.
they had to admit. And you've seen in a very short period of time, you also saw a White House staff person go very quickly after it was a plagiarized plagiarized article,
right.
op-ed piece.
Right.
And it seemed like the challenge to it, calling it plagiarized, went up on the web. I think his article went out on a Thursday, came up in the newspaper on a Thursday. The person who had the website wrote about it that same day.
Yeah.
And I think he was gone by the end of the day,
wasn't he?
He
was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it just amazed me that it moves that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
The web has been... it's been good in that way, and some of that, I mean, you can really tell whether something is accurate
right.
or it's not.
Right.
I mean, because you could just pull up the same thing yourself.
Right. Right.
I remember during the debates, the vice presidential debates, Vice President Cheney said that he had never met Edwards, and so by the end of that debate, there were pictures on
mm-hmm.
the web
mm-hmm.
of the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't take long to.
Right.
To get to things.
That's right.
So that certainly is a benefit of
right.
the web. But on the other hand, people feel overwhelmed by it. And how do you navigate your way through?
Well, you make judgment calls, and you sometimes you forfeit position. And by that I mean, you know, Bob Woodward was talking about his most recent book at the Washington Book Fair recently, last year, maybe the year before. And he said, you know, the thing that's changed is that we used to have weeks and weeks to work on a story, and now we have hours. And the point is that everyone knows when a story is out there, so to speak, and you don't have a lot of time to make a decision about whether the guts of something are really worth pursuing or not and putting up on your website. Because, you know, we don't wait for newspapers to come out in the morning anymore. I mean, we go online fast.
Mm-hmm.
And we run a blog. It's called The Swamp at chicagotribune.com. And we're up all the time. And and you make judgments. You have parties throwing things at you, political parties throwing things at you, just to try to get out there, because they know that once they're published, once they're online, they have a currency that other people look at, and it's taken seriously. And, you know, things come your way all the time, and you know that once you put it up, it's got that currency and other people will start to use it. So there's sort of this, you know, responsibility factor. It's not a sort of responsibility, it's a big responsibility factor, but there's also this imperative to get out there quickly with something that's worthwhile.
Uh-huh.
You want to publish. You want to be, if not the first, one of the first in the run on a good story, but you have to make that call. And sometimes you just sit back and you say, nope, sorry. You know, not here. And if you want to shop that someplace else, more power to you. But and the truth is, just about virtually everything that you see coming across the transom ends up someplace. I mean, you know, everybody, you can find a very low common denominator of standard if you look hard enough, and
mm-hmm.
And then it'll be on the web. And there's some papers in Britain that are, you know, famous,
uh-huh.
you know, for putting everything up. And I remember Jeb Bush years ago, the president's brother, had been forced to confront a rumor about a sexual infidelity that was being alleged, and it finally, when it everybody had heard about it on the internet, and it was known not to be true, and finally the British papers started putting it up, and he figured, well, at that point, U.S. papers were going to start doing it too, and he just had to confront it. So he did. He held a press conference ostensibly to say that I did not have sex with that woman. Uh-huh. And in this case, it was true. Uh-huh. Which was really bizarre because, I mean, he, you know, so we had exercised a lot of judgment in not publishing something, but finally somebody did, and then it had to be dealt with. And so I guess the bottom line is you want to be competitive and you want to be fast, but you don't want to be wrong, and you don't want to, you know, you don't want to libel people, and you don't want to help, you know, bad information spread across the internet, because it's, you know, in the current campaign, the idea that Barack Obama is a Muslim is one of these amazing little falsehoods that has an incredible currency on the internet, and it's everywhere. It's everywhere, and people write it in letters to the editor, and they post it in comments to blogs, and people write articles, and the internet is just filled with this. And you know, you wonder how, as a news organization, you can really effectively contain something which is not true, and how much time you should spend really doing it. I mean, we're not mm-hmm. Barack Obama's press office. It's not our job. But there's a lot out there that is just irrepressible. And once it's out there, it's just out there.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what the rhythms are of a week for you, of a work week? How many, starting out, kind of where you get your information,
yeah.
both newspapers, the hard copies, and then what you read online,
yeah.
what websites you go to, and then how many pieces you have to do, both articles
yeah.
for the paper and then for the Swamp.
Sure. The morning print papers start with the Washington Post and the New York Times, which are also online, but I still like to read a newspaper. Up early, looking at print papers, going online. And Nexus, actually, I like Nexus. I have a subscription to it. So if I want to search a subject, it's much easier to find out what's been written about the president that morning by looking at Nexus than by uh-huh. sifting through a variety of newspapers. So I don't spend a lot of time on an individual newspaper's websites so much as I do kind of looking at Nexus. And by subject area, if I'm covering the campaign as well, so I look at campaign coverage. There's a lot of political newsletters from the hotline to the ABC's The Note that you peruse. But you can spend all day because there's so
yeah.
much, you know. So you sort of do a quick read of your subject areas, the president, the campaign. If you're covering Israel at the moment, you know what's new on Israel, and then. Well, at the White House, the gaggle, the informal gaggle in the morning is a good gauge of where they're going in the day. You can get a sense that every morning they have an informal discussion about questions and answers, and you can sort of get a sense of where the White House is going. We don't really get caught up in a daily mill of every press conference and every event, every bill signing or everything the president does. We try to be more enterprising and to do more mm-hmm. in-depth, more analysis, stepping back a little. We don't get caught up in a daily, the president did this today, the president said that today. And so what may be a fairly typical week would be three articles during the week, maybe two daily pieces and then a longer analysis, whether it's a weekend piece or an analysis written during the week. That's a pretty common kind of week, three pieces. But that's not to say that on a given week I won't write five or six pieces or none. And as we've gotten more and more into the internet and are doing more and more online, there have been many days that we've really devoted a lot of work to that. And last week, before Paulson's announcement, actually the week before, I hadn't written anything that week, and then I wrote about Paulson and the Treasury on Saturday for the Sunday paper. It was on the front page. So it's not unusual to write one story a week. Three is kind of average. During the day, there's just a lot of continual reading of websites, political websites, newspaper websites, Nexus. Sort of reading as you go. You don't stop. I mean, you don't stop reading in the morning. You sort of read all day.
Yeah.
And then if you're working on something, then if you're working on a particular story, I'll spend a lot of time online at think tanks or university websites on that subject, or government websites, whatever, calling people, interviews, you know, reporting. So my day starts at dawn and it ends in the evening, I work at home, I work at the office, mm-hmm. I work with my laptop and I work with my BlackBerry, and you know, I'm not necessarily at the White House a lot. I'll be at the White House part of the day, but not a lot. If I want to go to see somebody, I'll go over, back over to see somebody. But I don't spend the whole day parked at the White House. Yeah.
Do you cover, when you're thinking of your beat, is your beat the president, or is your beat also the presidency as an institution and the White House?
Well, it's the president and the institution and everything they have their hands in, really. I mean, it's kind of a wide net. And it's the man, it's the administration, it's maybe not so much the institution itself, mm-hmm. you know, although you get into certain areas like the war powers. And,
right, and presidential power.
The presidential powers and the whole question of presidential prerogative and whether it really exists as, or it's something that's been, you know, seized upon by presidents. You get into issues of the power of the presidency and the prerogatives of the presidency, but then everything they have their hands in, and that would mean everything from domestic to international affairs.
Yeah. Okay. You ready for some questions? Well, let me ask you while they're getting their questions.
Sure.
And your story ideas, do you come up with the story ideas? Where does your editor come in?
There's a mix. Often it's my idea. Often it's an editor's idea. It's a mix. And sometimes there'll just be a, you know, a directive from an editor, you know, we really need to do a story on this. And it's not so much, I mean, you're not really told what that story is. It's just that, you know, we need to deal with this subject today. And so, you know, have at it. And uh-huh. so then it becomes sort of a question of you making an assessment of, you know, what you think is, you know, what you think is the germane, what's the trail to follow. So even sometimes when somebody says, we need to do a story on this, it's still, you're still in the position of deciding, well, how are we going to deal with it? You know, how are we going to pursue it?
Uh-huh.
But then often I'll just say, you know, we ought to do a story. So it works both ways.
Thinking of a story and of a question you asked, you were in a press conference that that President Bush had,
right.
One of his solo press conferences, and you were towards the back, and you asked him a state of mind kind of question. Can you tell the students about it, both in terms of how did you come up with your question? And what his response was to it.
Sure. This was after the latest national intelligence estimate had found that all the claims the administration had been making about Iran and its designs for a nuclear weapon were untrue. That yes, Iran had been enriching uranium, but the actual weaponization program, the program aimed at building a bomb, had stopped some 4 years ago. And so here was the president at a press conference having to concede that, you know, after 3 or 4 years of telling the people that, you know, Iran is a nuclear threat, had to concede that it's not true. And to me, this was very much like the concession he had to make after the invasion of Iraq, that mm-hmm. all the intelligence that led up to the, you know, all the intelligence that was used to justify the invasion was proven to be untrue. And a pretty signal moment in this guy's presidency. Here he was again, having to confront the American people with an
right.
acknowledgement that everything I've been telling you, I can't stand by anymore. And so in the press conference, people had sort of been around the block on all the substantive questions, that really all the good, hard questions you'd want to ask about the issue had been asked. And I wasn't going to start talking about, you know, something else. And it just occurred to me that this had to be kind of a painful moment. Plus, he had entered the room just really downcast and dour, and mm-hmm. He had this demeanor throughout, which was, it just showed, I mean, just sitting there looking at him, you could tell he was really not happy about being in this position. And I just thought, well, you know, we've asked all the substantive questions, why don't we try, you know, you know, I have to say, you look, the word wasn't downcast, but it was something like that. And I just, you know, I would just like to know, you know, what it feels like to be standing here again, having to confront the people, the American people, about an issue that you've been telling them. You know, you really put yourself pretty far out on this, and to have to concede to people that it's just not true. You know, what's going through your head? And he curled up. You know, it was, oh, you're not going to play psychology 101 on me. And then we did. We proceeded to play psychology, because he really sort of, he showed how uncomfortable he was with the whole thing. And I followed up, and he shut down the press conference. I mean, normally they go 45 minutes to an hour. Yeah. And that was it. It was over. He said, goodbye, thank you, we're done. Yeah. And that's the second time I've done that, by asking a question that got under his skin. And
what was the other one?
It was on Iran, and it was a few years before, when he said, similar subject, he'd said, he stood there and said, you know, a nuclear weapon in the hands of Iran is unacceptable. And I said, well, Mr. President, you told us, you know, we went to war on the assumption that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which proved to be untrue. And so now you're saying a nuclear weapon in the hands of Iran is unacceptable, and you're presenting the fact that they're developing this. Are we to assume that we're ready to invade Iran? I mean, we invaded when there was a weapon last time, and now there's a weapon this time. Are we going to go again? And he said, Iraq is not Iran. And he went on to talk about the differences. And he said, thank you very much, that'll be it. The press conference was over after 40 minutes. So, but, you know, I took some criticism for asking a personal question this last time. But I'm sorry, that I felt it was appropriate, and I think he showed just how uncomfortable he was with the whole situation and the way he handled the question.
One of the values of press conferences, you do get to you get to see him without his staff, giving him answers or shielding him in some way, and you get a view of him. For example, when Peter Mayer asked him in the last press conference about gas prices going up to $4 a gallon, and he was so surprised. That was a window into his thinking.
Oh yeah.
And do you find press conferences valuable?
No, I think they're very formal, and again, I sort of chafe at them, because it seems like we go around the block asking a lot of sort of predictable questions. And Peter's question was great, and it got a great answer. But I think the questions that produce revealing answers are really few. I mean, I think in the course of an hour-long press conference, few questions really elicit something that's really informative. And for the life of me, I can't understand why. You know, this president, a couple years ago, in an attempt to sort of re-engage with the press, started having off-the-record meetings with reporters, in which reporters would go and sit down with him in the residence and talk, and it was all off the record. And I've been through a couple of these, and they're wonderful. I mean, you sit and you talk for an hour with the man, and you hear all kinds of things, and you learn all kinds of things, and you can't report a word of it. And this, again, goes to my earlier criticism that I think the administration has done him a bit of disservice in shielding him, because I think if I were able to sit down and write an article based on each of those hour-long sessions, I think people would come away with interesting insights into the man himself that they didn't have. And so I, you know, I don't know why that happens. So I think I do know why it happens, because they want to control, and they want to sort of help you understand something about the guy to sort of inform your writing. But I think if they just sort of got out of the way and let the guy, you know, shine through, it would behoove him. In press conferences, he's guarded, even though he's out there by himself, he's guarded. And he's giving the administration line. I mean, he knows what the talking points are, and he can handle them very well. It's like the speeches he gives; he's internalized them, and he can riff. He can talk for an hour with or without a script, because he knows what the points are. I find press conferences frustrating, because they don't provide a lot of really great insight, and the moments of insight I think are relatively few.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, you have some questions? Yep.
You said you spent a lot of time online when you're writing a story. So I was wondering, what difference does the internet make in how you get your information?
Well, the internet enables me to get it very quickly. I mean, in the old days, and I belabor this, but you get on the phone and you call somebody up and they call you back about 6 hours later, and it turns out they don't have what you're looking for. And, you know, it's kind of an arduous process of trying to figure Wow. anything out. And now, I mean, you get to a reputable internet site, whether it's a university or a think tank or a government agency or whatever it is, and you can find out the information you're looking for very, very quickly. And not only that, but the professor that you want to talk to or the expert that you want to talk to probably has an email address there, and you can probably email him or her faster and get a response faster than you ever will through a telephone switchboard system. And I routinely, when I'm trying to get in touch with people now, I routinely email them first, and they'll call on their cell phone, you know, which is not listed on the university website. So it's just an amazing, it cuts through everything, and it just enables you to find out in an hour what it used to take you a day to find out.
But does it speeds up the cycle a lot, because you were expected to add to it. I mean, you add to the information that's out there, and so the time that you have for a story is going to be a lot less if you're putting it up on the internet.
Well, there's that truth. I mean, I'll never forget when we invaded Iraq. An editor asked me to produce a story about the big picture of the schisms within Islam. And you know, I'm not a religious scholar. And I had about a week to produce a piece about sort of the political fault lines in the world within Islam and in Indonesia and Africa and places, to try to give people an understanding of what this Shia Sunni, you know, hodgepodge we were thrusting ourselves. And I had a week to work on the story, and I think I produced a pretty intelligent story. I spent a good 3 days of research. Didn't have a lot of time for books, but I had a lot of time online. And then the last couple days interviewing people, and I got up to speed pretty quickly and produced it. But you can do that, so people expect a lot of you. And again, on a daily basis, people expect you to sort out a big issue fast. So yeah, you can't say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I need a couple days to work on that," because the truth is, you can figure it out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you can get a great deal about government and what government agencies are doing by the web?
Yeah. I mean, not only the agencies themselves, but groups that deal with the agencies, that monitor them, that watch them. I have a lot of good resources. And there's a lot of think tanks that are involved in tax issues or healthcare or, you know, every substantive issue. So the agencies themselves have a wealth of information. Again, it's, you know, somewhat selective and from their point of view, but there's a lot of good hard information. I mean, the government produces reams of data in every field, research and data, from agriculture to you know, space technology. NASA's got a very informative website. And again, even the CIA, which you think of as a secretive organization, runs the best online encyclopedia about the world that you can look at.
Yeah, I remember a long time ago when I was first getting into this subject, and I was talking to somebody about how they prepared for presidential travel. And the guy who was a radio reporter said that he went to the CIA and he asked for briefings at the CIA in those days, and it was the 1970s.
Yeah, yeah.
You could get them to give you a briefing.
Yeah.
Okay, another question?
Do you think it's important for news organizations to cover the vice president?
Oh, it certainly is, and particularly with this vice president. This has been the most powerful vice president in history, and you may not see another one like this. I mean, he has exerted a huge influence. This is a guy who, during the first campaign, when they hired him to go look for a vice president, to look for a running mate, he found himself. If you're familiar with the history, in 2000, they put him in charge of finding George Bush a running mate, and basically he came up with himself. And ever since then, he has had enormous influence. So, yeah, it's important that we cover the vice president. And the vice president is more elusive than the president because he doesn't keep as robust a daily schedule as the president does. Often, the vice president will go weeks or, you know, occasionally, I think months, a couple of months anyway, without really having any sort of public appearance. And so your opportunity to sort of see him in action is limited. Again, they have the same sort of press office that stands between you and his people that the White House has. And so you've got to go in through that door. And, you know, they're not necessarily going to make his chief of staff available to talk to you. So it's really important and difficult. It's important and difficult.
Why do you think these organizations haven't, say, created a beat of him?
Well, I think unofficially everybody who covers the White House considers him, the vice president, part of the beat. Some people have devoted serious resources. The Post devoted a serious amount of time to reporting about the activities of the Washington Post on sort of a special project basis for which they were honored. But I think any White House reporter considers the vice president part of the territory. But again, the vice president doesn't often show up very often. So he sort of falls off the radar. And then when they offer you these trips, you really have to ask yourself, are we willing to spend $30,000 to travel someplace without any opportunity to talk to anybody? Mm-hmm. You can answer that question pretty quickly.
Do you get to talk to other people if you don't get to the vice president?
To some extent.
Talk to Addington?
Yeah, well, not so much Addington, but John Hanna, the national security advisor to the vice president. Yeah, that's kind of the list runs out pretty quickly. You don't get to talk to a lot of people. Addington is not famously loquacious. The guy that's closest to Cheney now, since Scooter Libby left. But they do make certain people available, and but just not the vice president.
What about the First Lady, Isabel?
I like traveling with the First Lady. She's much more open. You travel in a smaller plane. Both her people and she are more accessible. You can talk to them. It's pretty easy to get an interview with her. It's pretty much considered, if you travel with her, that you'll get one. And her people during the trip are very accessible. I remember getting into a car once with her during the campaign in 2004, I'd requested an interview, and they said, well, the only really opportunity we have is from the car to the airport, and it'll be about a half an hour. So I said, fine. So I jump in the car, and I just looked at her, and I said, I like to start an interview with some niceties and, just sort of work into it a little bit and break the ice. I looked at her, I said, well, we don't have a lot of time, do we? And she said, no. I said, well, why don't we just get down to it? She said, yeah, let's do that. And so I just started hammering her with questions about, and all kinds of questions. She can take it. You can ask her anything about George Bush, critical, anything, and she can take it, and in great style, and really unflappable. And so she's a lot of fun to interview because she goes with the game. And so I like traveling with the First Lady. And I should say I like traveling with the Vice President, too, because he goes to really interesting places. It's just a little frustrating, the limitations on the accessibility.
Have you had any interviews with the President?
Not one-on-one. And I've requested them, and I've never been given one. Only, like I say, those off-the-record sessions where half a dozen of us sat down with him on a couple of occasions. Introductory meeting in the White House. When you first come on the beat, you go in and you meet the president. Again, off the record. But I've requested a number of personal interviews and have not been granted them. The president tends to give his interviews to the network news anchors and the New York Times, and occasionally, some conservative talk show hosts. They select pretty carefully. Presidential interviews.
Question?
Yeah. Do you find the White House to be a different place when it's campaign season?
Well, yes, a more combative place, maybe, more engaged in the, you know, the White House. Well, you have to look at it from two ways. This campaign, no. I mean, this campaign, the president made a real point of staying removed from the debate, and not until John McCain was the presumptive nominee and came to the White House and got the Rose Garden congratulations did he really express any opinion on the race, the president, that is. And so they've really stayed out of this race. I think they've really distanced themselves from it very well. I think they've done a very good job of staying above it, staying out of it. But back in 2004, when they were running for re-election, the White House was very much engaged. And again, you could sort of sense on any given day what the message was, no matter who you talked to. You talked to the White House, you talked to the campaign, you talked to the Republican National Committee, you could figure things out pretty quickly. It was all the same agenda. So I think, and during the midterm elections, in 2006, the president was very much engaged in campaigning for Republican candidates. We were all over the place. He was all over the place promoting, trying to keep a majority in Congress for his party, which he failed to do. But he was very, very actively involved. And so the White House was very much involved in the midterm campaign and certainly during his reelection campaign.
Did you go on the campaign for Social Security, for personal retirement accounts, the 60 stops in 60 days that went, I mean, basically that thing went along a lot longer than that, starting in the late winter and then going into the middle of summer to July.
I did a good deal of the beginning of it. I did the maiden, the initial tour, and I did some more. I did a lot. I did a lot of big swings on that Social Security tour, to the point where it became really clear that he wasn't getting anywhere with it. And the more he went to more places to say the same thing, and the more you realize that Congress just wasn't interested, people weren't biting on it, and the thing itself, the plan, was not showing much traction with the public. You know, the people just didn't. He went for months at it. He worked, you know, into July or August, I think.
Yeah, he did.
Until he finally gave up. But there came a point fairly early on where we realized that this wasn't getting anywhere too fast, so we sort of pulled back. And you know, there's only so many times you can go and hear the same speech delivered, and the same public reaction, which is not much receptiveness. So I was on the initial swings.
Yeah, it seemed to be an example of something where they didn't learn.
They didn't
and
listen.
That yeah. Actually, at the very beginning, if they had listened to people in the briefing room, what was very clear was, is there a problem with Social Security, and how is personal retirement accounts related to the problem?
Right.
I mean, that came up just so quickly that nobody believed that it was convincing, that there was any relationship between the two.
Right.
And they never were able to sell it. And you look at the polling on it, and it was higher when he began than when he ended.
Oh yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think is pretty unusual for
yeah, yeah.
for the kind of energy that they put into
well,
it.
The more people learned about it, the less they liked it.
Yeah.
And you know, Bush was reelected in 2004 with you know, I mean, a pretty good victory, a pretty tough race, and pretty good margin, and a lot of steam, and he was feeling pretty heady about the whole thing. And he said at the time, I have a lot of capital to spend, and I'm a lot of political capital to spend, and I intend to spend it. And he spent it all right on Social Security, but boy, if he had devoted himself to something that had a little more prospect, could have gotten a lot farther with that capital.
Uh-huh. The two issues that he put out were Social Security and immigration.
Yeah.
And those are two second-term loser issues.
Yeah.
Because it takes so much support to yeah. get them through. They're so unpopular
yeah.
to tinker around with either one of them.
Those are almost the stuff of one-term presidencies. I mean,
yeah.
you know, if there came a day when there were a president who had a really ambitious agenda, he would almost have to, or she would almost have to assume that this was a one-term presidency. If you were really going to achieve what you hoped to achieve, because it was going to cost you a lot, but mm-hmm. People don't think in those terms.
Question?
You said that the internet's a good tool because it gives you a lot of information, but also that the lowest common denominator exists where there's lots of wrong information. Do you think that more needs to be done to differentiate between reporters who blog and bloggers?
I think it's a matter of the buyer beware. Most blogs, this maybe isn't a fair generalization, but a lot of blogs have a political agenda. They have a point of view, they have a cause, and the bloggers see everything through the prism of their ideology, their political perspective. And you can find good, reliable information in the context of a political blog, but you can also find a lot of, you know, bias and misinformation. And so you just have to be extremely careful. A newspaper blog, at least what we hope to achieve, I mean, what we set out to achieve is to write in the currency of the bloggers. We're up fast. We try to be more, you know, conversant. We try to be easier to read. We try to be less formal and not stodgy like newspapers tend to be. But we want to be journalists online. We're trying to do journalism online, and we're trying to report, and we're trying to present online something which we hope is reliable as what we print. Now, we make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, and we try to correct them. We do correct them when we know of them, and we, you know, we invite people to point them out. But we're not perfect. But a newspaper blog, I think you can rely on ostensibly to be more factual. There was an interesting thing that came up a couple of weeks ago when a group, a pretty reliable group, put up something on their blog about a speech that John McCain had given in which the words were eerily similar to words that Admiral Tim Zimmer, who is a member of the Bush administration, had given 12 years before. It was about war and hating war, and nobody likes war. And they were very eloquent words, and they were the same words, and so it seemed pretty much on the face of it that, you know, John McCain's words were lifted right out of Tim Zimmer's words from a speech some 12 years earlier. Well, the McCain campaign had a pretty good response, which was actually McCain had given the same speech a year before Zimmer did back in 1995. So who'd copy who? You know, I mean, admirals probably don't write their own speeches, so the admiral speechwriters must have lifted something from McCain's speech at the VFW, Veterans of Foreign War. But in the course of that happening, the story went out that, that McCain had lifted words, and that story was out there long enough to be part of the currency, and then what ultimately turned out to be a bad story. It looked good. It looked, you know, I mean, look at the two speeches. Yeah, word for word. Looked like a copy to us. But actually, McCain had the first claim to the words some 13 years before. And the beauty of the internet is you can find those things. You can find those links. Look, here's the link to the speech that the senator gave to the Veterans of Foreign Wars in 1995. You know, this is the stuff of research libraries of years past. I mean, the things you can do in front of a computer tube now that used to take extraordinary amounts of time. But that's an example. So your question was, you know, the difference between newspaper and reporter blogs. Well, we had gotten that information from a partisan blog, a reliable, sort of, you know, reputable partisan blog, but that's what it was. So you just got to be really careful.
Does an editor go over your entries on the blog?
What happens is we sort of publish as we write, and we look at each other's work. And it's a little bit of peer review going on. When I post on the internet, I copy a few people, and they backread what I do, editors. They backread what I do. But we're sort of publishing as we go. And if we find problems, we pull them down. We have the confidence to do that because just I'm such an old, you know, pro. I've been around long enough that I've got a pretty good sense of what is publishable and what is not. And so I'm fairly reliable. And if somebody reads over my shoulder, it'll work out. But some places are a little more formal and go through a more more typical process where you submit something to an editor, an editor looks at it, then it goes online. But we're trying to, you know, newspapers are losing readership, and we're trying to bring people into what we write about in new ways. And so, you know, the blog seems like a really good, fast, and current way to do it. And so if we can get news and politics and analysis up as fast as possible, then we think that's a good thing.
Well, is it that you're losing readership or you're losing circulation? Because readership has grown.
Well,
it's just that papers, paid newspapers, that's what's gone down.
Yeah, well, don't tell that to the companies that own them, because you know, they're looking at, you know, they're looking at losses on the, even in the New York Times over the last 5 years, 8% loss. You know, Boston Globe 20% loss, Chicago Tribune 5 or 6% loss.
But with the websites,
it's
the number of people that are actually reading the paper has increased.
Oh yeah, we're increasing the universe of readers, and we have on a good day we have 100,000 page views of our blog, and we can even tell you how much time people spend there, and because it's all, you know, recorded, and we'll get 3 million page views during a month on a political blog, and that tells me that there's a readership. You know, there's an avid readership for politics and government. Contrary to what people would tell you, people tell you, oh, people don't care. They're jaded. They're turned off. They don't follow government or public policy. But, you know, we get a huge amount of readership on what we put online. And there's other sites that get more. And so I think, yeah, there is a universe of readers that we're trying to reach. And with the internet, we're just trying to keep up with the speed of the thing.
Do you think there's any way of making the internet pay? I mean, that people will ultimately have to pay?
I hope not. I don't think so. The Wall Street Journal charges you a subscription for their site. Well, you don't have to read it. You can get the same information someplace else, really. There's no reason to pay. There's no imperative for anybody to pay anything, because if somebody charges, you can just go someplace else and get it for free.
Well, except the imperative, the news organizations are in such trouble, in such financial trouble. And how do you, if people stop reading the hard copy of a paper, how is it going to pay?
Well, we're selling advertising. And so if you look at our blog, there's a little strip of advertising across the top, there's a little strip of advertising down the right side, and there's a little strip at the bottom. It's not too cumbersome, and we don't have big pop-up blocking things, you know. But it's there, and we're selling it. And the more viewers, the more readers that we get for the site, the more we can charge for advertising. So, you know, I mean, newspapers are a business venture that are paid for by readers and by advertisers, more so by advertisers than by readers. And so if we can continue to draw revenue, then we'll be in business.
Do you find that the nature of advertising has changed? That once they're with advertising on blogs, that it's going to be more national?
Yeah, it's more national, and it's more consumer-oriented. You know, in the old days, the newspapers were filled with big full-page ads for car dealers and department stores, and those were the staple. And now if you want to, you know, buy a car, you go to cars.com or something. You know, you don't go to a car dealership, or you go to a website. So it's more consumer-oriented. It's cell phones. We're trying to encourage political advertising as well. You know, issue advocacy and that sort of thing, because we figure if we've got readers who are interested in politics, they might be interested in issue advocacy advertising.
Questions? One more question.
Has the evolution of blogs influenced the way that you cover the White House, or any of your colleagues for that matter, the way that they cover the White House?
I think it's made for more coverage. You know, the internet is a bottomless barrel of ink. You can write forever, and you can publish. We probably had 20, 25 postings on the Swamp today. They weren't all about the White House. A lot of them were about David Petraeus and the testimony on the Hill today. But I can put up half a dozen postings. You know, I think I mentioned I might write 2 or 3 stories about the White House during the week for the newspaper. Well, I'll probably put up about 25 postings during the week on the internet about the White House or about Bush or about the war or about something that the White House has its hands in. And so I think it's enabled us to do a lot more. And when you're writing about somebody, you can put extensive remarks in. You know, you can, you know, newspapers are confined and you can only fit so much into a story and you can only quote so much of what somebody has to say. But, you know, on a blog, you want to run 5 paragraphs of what somebody has to say, you can. And I think it's great because you get the full context of what somebody's talking about. So I think it's opened things up more. I'm not sure it's changed the way we report, but I think it's just enabled us to report a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that that over the years in covering a political figure, that that the kind of information that you're looking for is different? Like if you're covering, well, you've just covered this president.
Yeah.
But say if you compare how you've covered him from beginning to end, has it been different? What you've been looking for, what a story is, does it make a difference as far as what kind of resources there are available? Are you still looking for the same things?
Yeah, well, you know, that's interesting because I think, for instance, at the beginning of this term, there was no lack of appetite for the Social Security question because it was big and it was new and we would travel. There was no question about traveling. And the president was trying to push something, so the question was, you know, this is something that might be going someplace, and so there was more a sense of there was more sense of possibility in the things he was talking about, and so I think there was more of a willingness to commit resources and to fly to Fargo, and see how it was playing there. And now, when George Bush proposes something, there's a realization that he's at the end of his term. There's not a great likelihood that it's going to go anywhere for all the political pressures and for all the reasons that the Democrats have in not wanting to help him. And, you know, it's just a fact of life. They're trying to elect a Democrat president, so the Democratic Congress isn't going to help him facilitate his agenda in the final year. So when the president proposes something, I think there's, you know, less attention paid to it, less resources. Are we going to travel to Nashville to hear him give the speech about that? No, we're not. Mm-hmm. Because why? Well, because we can probably spend our time better working on another issue that's more imperative and is actually going someplace, and we know this thing isn't going to go someplace. So and this isn't George Bush. This is the natural cycle of the presidency. Mm-hmm. In the last year, there's not a lot that you can expect.
Yeah. How much would that trip cost if you were to take a day trip, go to Nashville?
It can cost a few thousand dollars because if you're flying on the press charter, you pay a pro rata share of the airplane, and when the president travels, Air Force One travels, and a press charter travels, a car plane travels to carry the motorcade and all that. Lots of planes travel, but the press plane is full of reporters paying their way, and actually, the fewer reporters travel, the more it costs.
Right.
And lately, there's not a lot of newspapers traveling with the president. You can count on one hand. The newspapers that are traveling on domestic trips with the president today, we stopped traveling domestically mostly because it's just there's no payoff, and it can cost $5,000-$6,000 to go to, you know, California and back on a press charter.
Uh-huh. And what about abroad? Like say the trip to Africa.
Well,
what would that be a day?
You know,
the whole trip.
Well,
let's say. That was 5 or 6 days.
You know, you can count on $30,000-$40,000 for a lengthy overseas trip. Mm-hmm. You can spend $50,000 in a week abroad,
mm-hmm.
and we do travel on most of the foreign trips, and have now set up a rotation so that we and a partner paper will be traveling on all the trips, the Los Angeles Times, but. I've done a lot of foreign travel, and it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Thanks.